BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening. Hello and welcome everyone to another episode of BDNG Meets podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I'm the Education and Development Lead for the BDNG. And today I have great pleasure introducing Emma Rush, who is the CEO of Vitiligo Support UK. So fantastic to have you with us today, Emma. Thank you very much for joining us. And could you introduce yourself and just give us a wee bit of background?
Yes. Hi, Tina. It's lovely to be here. We've been talking about this for a while, so it's really nice to begin finally. So I'm Emma, and I am a vitiligo patient myself. I first got it about 20 years ago as a small patch, and then very characteristically, during a period of quite high stress, the disease spread quite dramatically and unfortunately spread to my face as well. So my father had had vitiligo, but never, ever talked about it or the impact on him. I think I could see that it had an impact on him because he was someone who was quite proud about how he looked. And he worked in marketing, which is a very people-facing job. And he was part of the reason I was inspired, first of all, to volunteer for another charity and then to set up Vitiligo Support UK, because I felt that there was a gap in providing support for people with vitiligo, just understanding the impact it has on you every day and trying perhaps a little bit to scaffold people's resilience to the disease. And then as time went on, it really became, because as we've been discussing, dermatology is in quite a deep crisis at the moment. So it became more about helping patients access even primary care, let alone secondary care. So how they could talk to their GP and get past that dismissal that patients like me often face when you want to talk about your disease and its impact and if there's any way of treating it.
Thank you so much for sharing your journey, because it is difficult to, you know, talk about this, and also memories, you know, of your father, like you were saying as well. And I think that's it, isn't it? You know, there's many people out there that really want to reach out. They don't want to be alone. You know, they want to share their story, but also to talk to others that have similar. And I think that's really important. And I know with the Vitiligo Support UK, I mean, how do you see different ages? How big is the, you know, how many people have you got on board with it? Is it, I know you say it's quite small, but do you have more and more people joining?
So certainly, so we've just been through the last stage of the NICE appeal for ruxolitinib, which I'm sure we'll cover a bit more later. And so something like that does bring more members in. I also think the support that we provide is quite a draw, but we are a UK or an England and Wales registered charity, so we don't have an international reach. We do work with an international group of charities to see what other people are doing. And of course, in Europe, they do have access to ruxolitinib, which I think is such a massive change in patients' lives. So we have 4,300 members. And out of those, I think it's reasonably mixed. So, you know, you don't see men posting every day, but there are men in the group who I know are struggling with it and who ask questions occasionally about, how should I cover up these patches? Which is more difficult for men, I think, because of the slight stigma about getting access to makeup. And I think that still is quite a female area of our culture. And we have a number of parents who have children with vitiligo. And that's incredibly moving, because you can see their struggle. They want their child to grow up to feel good in their skin, and yet they know what their child might face, particularly when you transition to secondary school and within secondary school itself. So that That's hard. The life of a parent with a child with a skin disease, any skin disease, I think is really hard because it's a balancing act between proactively seeking a treatment, but trying not by that seeking to sort of tell the child there's something wrong with them or, you know, they should be different. So I take my hat off to people who are managing that sort of issue at home, generally on their own without much support.
That's a really good point, what you've made there, you know, going through, you know, the different sort of people that you've, you know, made a difference to as well. You know, men can be very different, you know, they don't have the makeup side of things that maybe women possibly are a bit more familiar with. And then obviously parents as well of children. And I think what you're saying as well, it's a bit of an open book at the moment, isn't it, with, you know, the sort of, you can never get away from like things like social media. You know, you'll have children going into social media and it's the sort of stigma, the relationship with skin and, you know, the feelings of how people, when you go outside, you know, how you people approach you. And I think that's where, you know, support that comes through from the Vitiligo Support UK is absolutely fantastic. And also just to pick up a point as well that you were saying there about, you know, the new medications that obviously are licensed now in other countries.
Yes.
So you can understand the global interest. But again, when the differences are in the UK, it's very difficult, isn't it? I mean, how does that sit with you? How do you feel about that? And I know it's a difficult conversation to have, but, you know, it must be quite difficult for people that are approaching the support service as well.
So I feel passionate, angry, frustrated. So ruxolitinib is a drug that was originally put forward by someone called Dr. John Harris in the States, who's a vitiligo champion worldwide. It's not a drug that's been plucked out of thin air. It comes from the family of JAK inhibitors, which are used already for rheumatoid arthritis and atopic dermatitis and alopecia. So it is an anti-inflammatory drug with a very specific effect. It's not just that broad brush effect that you might get from putting a steroid cream on your skin. In Europe and in the United States, so the European Medicines Agency and the FDA have investigated the trial work that went on, which was really extensive. It included a lot of patients with different skin types, and they approved it. So if you live in France, that's like 30 miles away across the channel, you can get access to ruxolitinib and it works for your vitiligo. If you live in Kent, 30 miles away from France, you cannot access it unless you can pay privately £1,000 a month for the tube of cream. And I just feel that's so wrong. So we've been part of the NICE approval process from the outset as a patient support group. We tried to provide evidence to them of the impact on patients and the real significant need for a licensed treatment for this disease. So if you look at almost any other skin disease, maybe not some of the kind of orphan rare diseases, but most of them have a specific licensed treatment that treats the cellular changes that relate to that skin disease. And we are still applying steroid creams. And steroid creams are fantastic. You know, they changed medicine when they were first brought in because of their anti-inflammatory effect. But it's 2025. You know, my father got vitiligo in 1970 and he was given a steroid cream.
Wow.
That's 55 years ago and we are still relying on that treatment. Okay, fair enough if there was nothing else on the market, but there is. Here it is, ruxolitinib, extremely effective and extremely effective specifically for the cellular changes that occur in vitiligo. And for NICE to keep saying, and I understand it's about cost effectiveness, but I look at the government who found £6 billion for, you know, the Ministry of Defence, and I think actually this is about NICE stepping up as a statutory body and saying the drug budget needs to start recognising psychological diseases because they are also physiological, and they need to recognize dermatological diseases as a very significant part of the need within the National Health Service. More money is needed. You know, we're all taxpayers, and yet as a taxpayer, I'm told as a vitiligo patient, we can give you nothing. And if you get put on a waiting list for secondary care, you are likely to be triaged out behind other inflammatory skin conditions. That's disgraceful.
It's very difficult, isn't it? And, you know, we know NICE is there for a reason, definitely. And I know, you know, I can hear the pain in your voice as well. And, you know, I know what has been going on at the moment behind the scenes, a lot of work and, you know, a lot of hope really for patients with vitiligo to have treatments available to them. And unfortunately, it's not just vitiligo, it's other skin diseases as well, which can be really, really difficult.
No, I understand.
Absolutely. And you mentioned there about the psychological impact that it has on, you know, on a lot of people. I mean, is there other support there for psychological, you know, I know there's things like changing faces. Could you explain a wee bit more about that for our audience today as well?
Yeah, sure. So Changing Faces is a national charity, and it does provide a lot of sort of non-skin specific visible difference focused support to patients. So it has support groups, and it has different resources available on its website, which are all fantastic. But the other main thing that it does for vitiligo patients is provide the National Camouflage Service. And I think specifically, in a way for men, that is a fantastic way of being able to see someone face to face, because you might not see a dermatologist face to face, and talk a little bit about the impact your skin disease has, and then find a practical solution. So I know that there are a number of patients who've said, actually, I'd rather use fake tan drops in a moisturizer or self-tanning product. But I think there's still a core of people who find camouflage, you know, a reliable resource to cover up some of the patches on their faces or their hands. And if you go to Changing Faces, it's a free service, a donation is asked of you. And then after that, you can get a letter that you take to your GP, and you should be able to get it on prescription as well. So your camouflage products should come on prescription to you. So that's a fantastic service to be providing patients. And again, it's not just vitiligo. It's a range of people with different skin conditions, but vitiligo patients find it enormously helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know myself, you know, I have patients that have found it very beneficial. So for our listeners out there, how do we know how to contact Changing Faces? Is it more local to their hospitals, or how do you find out about Changing Faces?
It is incredibly easy, and the patient can manage the whole thing themselves. So you go to their website, search camouflage, the page will come up for camouflage. And then they complete a form. There are waiting lists, but it depends on local areas, but it will be local to them. So they get on the waiting list, and then they will have an appointment with what they call a camouflage practitioner. And it can be managed exclusively by the patient, which I think, again, gives patients a bit of autonomy and control over what they're doing.
And is that free, Emma? Is that free for patients as well?
Yes. So the service is free, but Changing Faces, because it's a charity that, you know, runs like the rest of us on small budgets, asks for a donation. So you don't have to give a donation. We'd recommend that you do, because the work they do is fantastic. But in essence, it's free. And then you would pay for each product that you get on prescription. You'd pay the prescription charge, unless you have thyroid disease as well. So if you have thyroid disease, you get your prescriptions free. And so other items such as camouflage would also be free. And there's also quite a strong link between thyroid disease and between vitiligo. So that is quite common.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really useful information. You know, because we do have a lot of nurses out there that, you know, there's not many, I think, nurses specialised in vitiligo or specific clinics. So again, possibly, you know, these patients might arrive in the sort of clinics and, you know, which direction do we point or which direction do we go with these patients? So, you know, it's really useful for nurses to know about that as well. And is there anything else that we could be pointing our patients to? I know changing faces is definitely the one I would think with most people would know about. Is there any other resources that are useful?
You could look at the Centre for Appearance Research at the University of the West of England. So, for example, they have a really useful game that can be played in schools. It's like a board game. And if your child was at school, say primary school, and experiencing difficulties, you might apply to them and get a copy of that just to deal with some of those issues. I mean, generally, there isn't a lot of vitiligo-specific information stroke resources out there. You could refer them to us, obviously. I think the really important thing, and I'm sure your BDNG nurses are all amazing at this, is just to make sure that you look a vitiligo patient in the face. Don't scan their face for their patches. Don't mention their patches, like say, oh, I can see you've got one all over your neck. Yeah. And also, I think quite importantly, so quite a lot of people who work, somebody phoned me and said that he was a takeaway delivery driver and people didn't like taking the takeaway from his hands because he had vitiligo. So I think that whole thing about, you know, touch and being seen and acknowledged for some patients is extraordinarily important. They probably won't get that opportunity in a very rushed appointment with a consultant who may, even in the best of circumstances, have dismissed them. I think you, as an outstanding profession, just have that chance to make up a little bit for that gap in the service by kind of acknowledging what the disease is and has brought to people. And I remember going to see my endocrinologist, and he had two students in with him. And he said, oh, can I use you as a kind of patient example and talk about your skin? And I was kind of a bit backward at coming forward. So I said, okay. And then he immediately turned to these two women students in the room and said, can you see what's wrong with her skin?
Oh, thank goodness.
And so that kind of thing should be stamped out. And so also, you know, if you see a consultant doing something like that, step forward. I was rubbish and didn't step forward at all, but step forward and say, I'm not sure that's the right way to handle this. Yeah. And also remember too that there are treatments for vitiligo. They're not particularly effective, but a patient regains some of their confidence and sense of control if they're told, you can use a topical treatment, let's try it out and see if it works. And then after that, you can come back and we'll consider you for narrowband UVB, because they just get dismissed before those discussions even take place, which is dreadful.
Absolutely, yeah. And I, you know, it's hard to hear these conversations and hard to, you know, hear it from yourself as well. It's very difficult. But I think, like you say, nurses are well placed, you know, to treat people like an individual, to yes. listen, to have that eye contact, to make sure the room is, you know, as nicely set up as possible as well. You know, somebody said to me the other day, to walk into a room and have two chairs there even makes a big difference, because, you know, that's welcoming somebody that can actually have their partner or a family member or a friend with them as well. And I thought, gosh, it can be as simple as that, you know, two chairs in a room. And I think nurses definitely can build rapport very, very quickly with their patients as well, which is well placed. And as we've mentioned, you know, we don't have specialists. We don't have, you know, the specialist clinics that we might have with other skin disease. So, you know, it can be quite difficult. But I think having, you know, resources, we know what's there, can make a massive difference as well. So we're not changing the world. We're just helping, you know, the individuals as well. You mentioned treatments there, Emma. Could you quickly, without going into great detail, just explain to our listeners today what is on offer for vitiligo, what, you know, you've come across?
Okay. So first of all, if I could just chip in and say there are, in fact, two specific vitiligo clinics in England, which are at the Royal Derby and Guy's and St Thomas's. So really important, if you live in those areas, to ask for a specific referral to those two clinics, so they can continue to kind of build their impact and importance. So on offer, if you go and see your GP, you should be offered a potent steroid for your body patches in the first instance, not for the face. And you should be given advice, as you guys will all know, about varying that with a moisturizer, because there's always that skin thinning demon in the background that people have searched on the internet and found that out. So an emollient that the patient owns in conjunction with the steroid. Our advice is to try that. So to take a photograph yourself as a patient with something next to the patch you're treating, like a 5P or something like that. Take a photograph at the start, 2 weeks in, and at the end of 4 weeks, and if nothing is happening, go back to your GP and say, I'm not sure this is working. Can we talk about what's next? Body patches, what's next would generally be a referral to secondary care to examine the option of narrowband UVB. For the face, you're looking at a calcineurin inhibitor. So generally, protopic tacrolimus is used, but some patients, particularly neurodiverse patients, because protopic is quite a greasy ointment, don't like that. And so there is another one, Elidel, that's on offer, which is a cream, which is easier for some patients to use on the face. And you can use that around the eye area, whereas you should never use a steroid, as you guys will all know, around the eye area. So gaining access to narrowband UVB is quite difficult. So first you have to go through the hurdle of getting up the waiting list to see a consultant dermatologist. Then you have to argue your case as someone who's eligible for narrowband UVB. And in a kind of reverse racism, white people tend to be dismissed. They're told that it doesn't have an impact on them. Their skin won't respond well. They shouldn't really be in the system. So you have to push again to get to that. And then you have to face the whole issue around convenience. So when we were talking to NICE, we were saying that some people in some jobs get the capacity to come in late twice a week. You're talking about a whole year of treatment. And if you have a very visible job, so if you work with your hands or you work in retail or you're on a factory shop floor, you have got to be there. You've got to be there at sort of 8:30 until 5:30. And so it's very hard then to negotiate a 365-day-long period in which 2 days a week you won't be there. So I would suggest there's quite a lot of inequality inherent in that treatment, inevitably. And I would really urge Wes Streeting to bring those phototherapy units kind of closer to the community, so it is much more convenient for people to pop in after work and have your very short burst of narrowband UVB. But it's still the hassle, isn't it, of getting to hospital if you don't have a car. Maybe waiting a few minutes, getting dressed again, then going back to where you work, which isn't necessarily on a straight line bus route from the hospital.
Yeah, I mean, it's not always realistic for people to, you know, have certain treatments, is it? I mean, that is the fact, and you know, we understand that as well. And I think that's it, isn't it? Explaining to patients and sitting them down, and also to reach out to the specialised clinics as well, like you really fantastically mentioned there. You know, you can reach out to, you know, the specifics like Guy's and St Thomas's, you know, which we know have these specialised clinics in a lot of skin diseases. So it's always good to reach out. And we don't need to invent the wheel all the time as well. You know, the support and everything's there, and, you know, we can do what we can. We have restrictions, but we can do what we can, definitely. Yes. And I did notice, I'm not going to mention the name of a certain store, but it you know, that it had models, you know, photographing, you know, with the clothes and a patient with vitiligo. So again, you know, I think people are sort of standing up and looking at, you know, the benefits of sort of destigmatizing, you know, people with skin diseases as well, which must be really positive. It's a positive spin on it, definitely, I think.
It's a mixed blessing, I think. I think it's great that you see more people with vitiligo in those public facing situations. But in essence, they're monetizing our skin disease. And I don't know, it's like, I think it would be great if they use psoriasis patients, because then what they're really saying is actually we're looking past the disability, not this condition of vitiligo, which actually can be quite kind of quirky and attractive in some people. Do you know what I mean? I think.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. You know, the model that I can't remember her name, but I know there's a model that, you know, is very famous and has sort of brought it to attention. And I think that's probably the spin of, you know, certain stores that are doing that. But yeah, I totally agree. It should be all, you know, we have, you know, a lot of skin conditions.
Disabilities.
Yeah, it should be. It shouldn't be, oh, let's just do flavour of the month or whatever. You know, it should be normalising it. And I think, you know, there's a lot more work going on that, but I think we've got a long way to go, definitely. But I can totally understand, Emma, you know, that's the feelings that, I, you know, you will have about that as well. It can be quite difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what I wish is that that had an impact on the woman who mooded a little girl with vitiligo, and her parent was telling us about that, you know, had an impact on, like I was saying, the people who won't touch the hands of someone with vitiligo. It's really hard to know how long it'll take for culture to change and become tolerant of difference. And as you said before, social media is such a mixed blessing, isn't it? So in some ways it raises awareness of difference and allows people to find their tribe and be comfortable with them. But it also imposes these impossible standards on, particularly I think, women, but increasingly men as well. So that, you know, you think, well, certainly young girls, if you go past our secondary school local to us, they all have long hair, they all have short skirts, they all carry the same bag. And maybe that's a rite of passage, but I feel slightly depressed that, you know, we worked so hard for feminism and, you know, liberty, and yet we're still imposing on women these universal standards of how you should look. It's hard, isn't it?
It's a tricky one. I don't think, you know, we're never, you know, it's going to be a lot of years ahead before we get it right 100%, because I don't think it ever will. You know, that's the thing. It's very difficult. The fact that I think the important thing is we're definitely, you know, speaking more about it, the effect, the psychological effect. And also, I mean, you've already mentioned schools. You know, is there any education going on in schools that you know of, Emma, about vitiligo specifically? You mentioned there about there was a game, but is there anything else that you've heard of that maybe primary you're working with schools?
Not that I know of. I mean, it is a ripe area, isn't it? I'm sure lots of people listening will have seen Adolescence, which was so powerful. But one of the really shocking things about it, I think, was the state of the school that they visited, and that the lad was a pupil at. And I think there's so much work to be done with schools on so many different issues. So yes, you're right. I don't think there's anything as yet for students specifically in secondary school, although the Centre for Appearance Research at the University of West of England is fantastic, and it has been working on what's known as acceptance and commitment therapy. Yeah. And I believe that there is a product online there that you can work through, which I think will be incredibly helpful to teenagers in just trying to kind of affirm the importance of difference and of trying to live within your values as a teenager and navigate that very sort of thorny path through school. So yeah. Again, have a look at their materials. I think they have got some fantastic stuff. And again, Changing Faces will provide support in some shape or form, I believe, in that area. But it's a really tricky phase in people's lives, isn't it, I think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's so many other issues as well, isn't it? So it is very difficult. And yeah, we've definitely, with the BDNG, you know, we've reached out to the Centre for Appearance as well. They've done things for us with podcasts and articles. So, you know, they're doing some fantastic work there, and that will just progress. I know that it'll just, you know, continue over the years and years. So we're basically coming to the end of this podcast, Emma. I can't thank you enough for opening up about everything that you've been talking about today. And I know it can be extremely difficult at times as well. I know the passion that you've got behind, you know, vitiligo as well. Before we wrap up this session, is there any key messages you would like to say to our listeners today, and also just the direct link as well for the Vitiligo Support UK, just so our listeners can obviously have a wee look there as well?
I think just acknowledge that this is a significantly impactful disease. It has a comorbidity with thyroid disease, which if you dismiss a vitiligo patient will then be missed because the symptoms are quite diffuse and principally in women who are more dismissed than any other member of the population. I think it's just to understand that this is a treatable disease. Please explore treatment options with patients, because that gives them some acknowledgement of the journey that they're going on and, you know, the suffering that inevitably they will be going through, and just acknowledge them as a person and not as a disease. I think that's really important, because so often people will look at you and clock your vitiligo rather than doing what you normally do when you meet someone, which is making eye contact. And there's that slight freeze moment. So I really urge your BDNG members not to do the freeze moment, just kind of welcome people, because they may well also be the first health professional who has acknowledged and recognised them for who they are and for what they're going through.
That's really important. And, you know, it should be basic as well, shouldn't it? Definitely. And, yeah. You know. And I think, you know, when a patient says, you know, to any healthcare professional, you're the first person that's treating me like me and not just my skin, it just makes such a big difference. And I think, you know, we are well placed to be doing that. Yes. And it's fantastic, Emma, what you've spoken about, you know, the support that can be offered and also, you know, the treatments and what is out there. And I know there's difficulties there as well, but even the basics can make a big difference. And, you know, if that's what we have to work with at the moment, that's what we have to deal with. And I know there's a lot of champions out there that are fighting your corner as well, which is really positive. So thanks again, Emma. Thank you very much indeed. Is there anything you'd like to say just before we leave this podcast today?
Just like to say thank you to dermatology nurses. I think you do an absolutely amazing job. And we're really grateful that you provide that really professional but human supplement to dermatology consultants. I know that you're all under enormous pressure, but thank goodness you're there.
Oh, thank you very much, Emma. And no doubt we'll hear from you very soon. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.